Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining the Christian Science Monitor, read by Daniel Williams. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. Article 1, Control of the U.S. House is up for grabs and may hinge on two blue states. Article 2, A Bridge to Humanity, Behind a Monitor series on an underreported story. Article 3, Abortion on the Ballot, What's Happening in 10 Key States. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Article 1, Control of the U.S. House is up for grabs and may hinge on two blue states. This article was written by Francine Kiefer. California and New York are reliably Democratic, so no suspense there for Tuesday's election. Right? Wrong. These two states may well determine control of the U.S. House of Representatives, where Republicans currently hold a whisker-thin majority. If Democrats can flip just four seats, they will retake control. And California and New York have more swing districts than anywhere else, including many GOP-held seats in districts Joe Biden won in 2020. Between them, they may well determine whether the House acts as a brake or gas pedal for the next president. In this era of tight margins, it's not a given that Democrats will get what they need in these blue bastions. And even if they do, the gains could be canceled out in other states where Republicans are trying to flip seats, such as Pennsylvania, Michigan, Alaska, and Maine. The fight for the House is as close as the fight for the presidency, and I don't think either party has a clear advantage in either one of those races, says Nathan Gonzalez, editor and publisher of the nonpartisan Inside Elections. With partisan gerrymandering greatly reducing the number of competitive districts across the United States, Mr. Gonzalez's nationwide rankings list just 15 pure toss-ups, five of which are in New York and California. Four more seats in those states are rated as competitive, but slightly favoring either Democrats or Republicans. The coattail effect. House races are notoriously hard to poll, and in an era of nationalized politics, the top of the ticket in a presidential year can have a huge impact. Democrats feel they got a reprieve when President Biden dropped out of the race last summer, and Vice President Kamala Harris became the nominee. They're hoping she'll draw more voters to the polls and that those voters will pick Democrats all the way down the ballot. California is Ms. Harris's home state, and she has support from 59% of voters there. That strength could be the difference in competitive districts like CA-13 in the agricultural Central Valley, where Republican Representative John Dewart beat his Democratic opponent by a mere 564 votes in 2022. Similarly, Republican Representative Mike Garcia eked out a win in CA-27 in northern Los Angeles County by 333 votes in 2020. On Sunday, Mr. Garcia's Democratic opponent, George Whitesides, rallied volunteers for a homestretch push at a park in Santa Clarita, a northern suburb of Los Angeles. The district's lines were redrawn after the last census, and Democrats now outnumber Republicans there. Still, Trump trains of pickup trucks and flags run regularly through this part of the Mojave High Desert, home to a state prison and Edwards Air Force Base. The heavily Latino district has thrice elected Mr. Garcia, a decorated Navy combat pilot and former Raytheon executive. Mr. Whitesides, who is running as a moderate Democrat, has an aerospace background as the former CEO of the Mojave-based space tourism company Virgin Galactic, and a former chief of staff of NASA. His wife is Cuban and Salvadoran. He boasts of having created 700 local jobs, an important consideration for commuters to Los Angeles, who battle two-hour drives each way, high gas prices, and higher housing cost as more people move from L.A. to the exurbs. The Garcia campaign is attacking Mr. Whitesides for his political donations, including to unpopular progressive L.A. County District Attorney George Gascon and the LGBTQ plus advocacy group Equality California. The group supported a bill equalizing sentencing for sex crimes. An attack ad accuses Mr. Whitesides of having funded a group opposing pedophiles registering as sex offenders. The Whitesides campaign is hitting Mr. Garcia for his votes against the bipartisan infrastructure bill and against the bill that included a price cap on insulin for older adults, and for rejecting the electoral count for Mr. Biden in 2020. And they've hammered the congressman for his no-exceptions opposition to abortion, though in a statement, Mr. Garcia says he does support exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother. In an interview, Mr. Whitesides said, "Choice is obviously a huge deal. That cuts across demographic groups and parties. Even though the California Constitution protects reproductive rights, voters are worried about a national ban and concerned for women in other states," he says. With polls showing his campaign ahead by 2 points, he says he feels cautiously positive. A 2022 drubbing for New York Democrats. On the other side of the country, in New York, Democrats have high hopes for retaking the seat held by Representative Brandon Williams, a first-term Republican who represents Syracuse. In 2022, the former Navy submarine officer defeated his Democrat opponent by less than 1 percentage point, and his all-in stance for Donald Trump puts him at odds with his redrawn district, which shifted from Biden plus 7 to Biden plus 11. Democrats are aggressively going after 3 more New York seats and eyeing a cherry on top at the tip of Long Island, says Jacob Smith, an assistant professor of political science at Fordham University. In the 2022 midterms, held not long after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, Democrats did better than expected nationwide, with an anticipated red wave largely failing to materialize. But in the Empire State, the party got swamped, says Professor Smith. That drubbing in New York, however, now means Democrats have an opportunity to win back those seats. Professor Smith points to an October poll by Siena College that shows Ms. Harris leading Mr. Trump by 19 points among likely voters in the state, a big jump from September when she led by 13 points. If the trend holds, that sort of a rising tide lifts all boats, he says. On the other hand, in California, state GOP chairwoman Jessica Milan Patterson lists lots of reasons she believes the environment is fantastic for us. Mr. Trump may be polling at only 33% in the state, but that's little change from 2020, when Republicans picked up 4 House seats there. Before that, they hadn't flipped a seat from blue to red in California since 1994. They gained another in 2022. Republican registrations overall in California have been rising after years of decline. Ms. Patterson notes that since she took over party leadership in 2019, it has registered more than 820,000 new Republicans. Party investments in community centers that serve Latinos and Asians in swing districts have made a huge difference, she says, noting that Representative Garcia gained 18 points among Latinos from 2020 to 2022 after the GOP created a community center in his district. The party saw a similar shift in Republican Representative David Valdao's Central Valley District, CA-22, where it has another Latino center. Ms. Patterson, herself Latina, says Latino voters are the pathway back to sanity in the state. The independent Cook Political Report notes that Democrats are showing signs of slippage overall in California, with Ms. Harris running 6 points behind Mr. Biden's 2020 vote share in a recent poll, and that slippage appears to be driven largely by Latinos. While Mr. Biden won that group by nearly 40 points in 2020, the vice president is currently winning them by only 20. Republicans have an easy explanation for all of this: persistent problems with homelessness, border security, affordability, and crime. California Democrats have destroyed the Golden State, says Ms. Patterson, pointing to high levels of support in polls for Proposition 36, which would increase punishment for certain drug and theft crimes. Crime is something Scott Bowe hears a lot about when he knocks on doors. The Republican former state legislator is running for the open seat vacated by Democrat Katie Porter in Orange County, where seats have flipped back and forth between parties. This district, CA-47, has been reconfigured and is rated by most election analysts as a toss-up or lean Democrat. But Mr. Bowe is ahead of his challenger, Democratic State Senator David Minn, by at least 3 points in some polls. People are uniting around the constant stories about crime, says Mr. Bowe in an interview at a rally in Newport Beach on Saturday. Many voters here were shaken by a murder during a botched robbery outside the city's upscale Fashion Island Mall this summer, followed a month later by another robbery and shooting there. All of our Orange County Republicans are going to get reelected. I'm going to be elected. Even Democrats know that, says Mr. Bowe, on a morning thick with marine fog. We will maintain the House majority and grow it, he says with confidence. With polls that lie within the margin of error, no one will know until after Election Day. Even then, it could be weeks before the outcome is clear because of the heavy use of mail-in ballots in California and the time it takes to count them. Article 2 is A Bridge to Humanity, Behind a Monitor series on an underreported story. Yes, the U.S. presidential election will be consequential. And yes, big powers and proxies are being drawn into high-profile conflicts. Our international news editor tells why and how we went deep on Sudan too, where a civil war has been devastating, but where resilience and agency endure. This article was written by Clayton Collins and Mackenzie Farkas. A land war in Europe, widening strife in the Middle East, a U.S. presidential election. The West tends to lose sight of the African continent even in less distracting times. But there's plenty that's worth attention in the more than 50 countries there. Sudan's current conflict is especially stark. What makes it really grave is that both sides are using starvation as a weapon of war, says Peter Ford, the Monitor's international news editor. Also present in Sudan, cooperation, resilience, and agency. Our stories in and from Sudan are about how people can rise above that chaos and the difficulties, that they can find ways of working together to overcome their problems, Peter says on our Why We Wrote This podcast. That coverage, which included a recent series organized by Johannesburg-based editor Ryan Lenora Brown, helps give readers a really different picture of life in Africa. The work builds a bridge for Monitor readers. It's a kind of bridge of humanity, if you like, Peter says, and I find it a very fulfilling job to keep that bridge maintained. Episode transcript. Peter Ford. Other media call themselves papers of record. I like to think of the Christian Science Monitor as the paper of record of unexpected success. Clay Collins. That's the Monitor's Peter Ford, our Paris-based international news editor. He joined the show last in late 2022 to talk about surfacing stories from the world over that highlight credible hope. As we near the end of 2024, a land war grinds on in Europe's east and could now be drawing in North Korea. In the Middle East, a year-old conflagration rooted in decades of enmity appears to be widening those conflicts. Hold the world transfixed and, well, a U.S. presidential election has pretty much taken whatever sliver of attention was left over. The West tends to forget about the African continent, even in less distracting times. But Africa watchers know that there's plenty there worth attention. In recent years, coups have roiled countries in a belt running from Guinea to Sudan. In sub-Saharan Africa, in particular, famine persists. There is also, of course, vibrancy and innovation, cooperation, resilience, and agency. This is Why We Wrote This. I'm Clayton Collins. Peter joins me today to discuss a burst of Monitor stories this month about, and mostly written from, Sudan. They were orchestrated by a staffer on Peter's team, Johannesburg-based Africa editor Ryan Lenora Brown, who joined this podcast herself recently to talk about finding African voices to tell stories from Africa. Hey, Peter, thanks for joining to supply a foreign editor's view. Ford, very glad to be here again with you. Collins, you've written from and edited stories from a lot of places many Americans don't necessarily make room to think about. The situation now in Sudan is especially tough with war widening and with one UN observer of Rwanda from 94 even hinting that such a genocide could be repeated in Sudan. Why is it so bad right now? And do you have a sense of whether the sides, both of which have been accused of war crimes, can be separated maybe without outside intervention? Ford. Well, this war's been going on now since April of 23, so it's about 18 months. And the problem is that neither side seems to have a decisive advantage, but neither side is ready to give in or perhaps, you know, start some peace talks. There have been a couple of efforts in the direction of peace talks, but they've not gone anywhere. You wonder whether outside powers might be able to help. The difficulty there is that the outside powers that are most heavily involved in Sudan have intervened on behalf of either one belligerent or the other. They're not intervening as peacemakers. The United Arab Emirates, for example, is known to support the Rapid Support Force, which is a paramilitary group fighting the Sudanese army, and Iran is backing the Sudanese army. What makes it really grave is that both sides are using starvation as a weapon of war. A UN fact-finding team was in the country earlier this month, and they issued a very stark warning at the end of their trip last week. They said, and I quote here, "Never in modern history have so many people faced starvation and famine as in Sudan today." Now, that's not the kind of news you could ignore, is it? Collins, right. It's a brutal, intractable conflict. The Monitor, of course, works to counter the perception that conflicts like that and crises don't completely define even those places where they're perennial. That means looking hard. Ryan, for instance, has described her job as a journalist as being, quote, to draw the world in closer. And she wrote recently in a Monitor Weekly column introducing the Sudan series, "I think the best reporting is the kind that helps us brush up against people in situations that feel far away, inexplicable, or simply hopeless." Here's Ryan from an episode on which she appeared in August. Ryan Lenora Brown. "I, from my region, get a lot of pitches or am responding to a lot of news that is bad news, that is a war, a refugee crisis, a natural disaster, something like that, you know. And the normal way, the straight news way to cover that is just, you know, this terrible thing happened. This many people died. Maybe if you want to go click further, like, this is why it's as bad as it is. And so I'm forever saying to people that, you know, when we do a story on a topic like that for the Monitor, we want to do something, come at it with a slightly different lens. And it's not to say that I want us to try to manufacture optimism about situations that don't warrant optimism about terrible things happening in the world. I'm not saying that. But I think there's always somewhere in a dark situation that you can find reasons for hope, even if it's just watching some people extend a hand to others, you know? It's watching someone's resilience in the face of very terrible circumstances, the way that they find to go on, the way that ordinary life continues to exist in the margins of terrible things happening. Collins. I want to talk specifically now about the short series of Sudan stories the Monitor ran earlier this month. It included an anonymous essay from Khartoum about a journalist navigating being a new parent of a child who had a really rocky start. A remarkable piece, Dateline Nigeria, about Sudanese community aid groups, community kitchens, rallying and improvising to share food. A quite chilling one from inside Sudan on a family of refugees, and about the moral complexity of people who essentially smuggle such families, and a story from a settlement camp in Uganda about a man there using the food of his homeland Sudan really as a kind of identity lifeline. Ford. Yes, well, these four stories really do talk to just what Ryan was saying back in August. You know, talking about resilience in the face of terrible circumstances. Our stories in and from Sudan are about how, even in the midst of disasters, people can rise above that chaos and the difficulties, and they can find ways of working together to overcome their problems, which is, you know, when we do it well, covering wars and crises like that, from that sort of angle, it really gives readers a picture of a really different picture of life in Africa. It gives them a picture of humankind, really, at its noblest. Now, we can't do that, obviously, and of course we have to balance this sort of coverage with less positive aspects of reality, because we're not blind to reality. But at the Monitor, we keep our eyes peeled for the positive. Other media call themselves papers of record. I like to think of the Christian Science Monitor as the paper of record of unexpected success. Collins. How did you and Ryan find and assign these specific stories and decide when you had a complimentary set that was ready to run? Ford. Well, Ryan's always on the lookout for stories, prodding stringers whom we know and ask them to pitch, and finding good ideas and pitches from people who don't really know what they're about. But, you know, send stories in, or send pitches in on spec, as it were. In this short series, two stories were written by stringers. Two others came from an outfit called EGAB. This is an organization we've been partnering with for some time. They commission stories from local reporters in Africa and the Middle East, and then they present them to international papers like us. So it gives local reporters a much broader audience, and it gives us a deeper pool of stories. And we can edit them any way we like, and we can go back to writers, and we talk with them directly. And we found it really quite a fruitful relationship. Collins. I feel like there's a careful line to watch in covering crisis spots between not glossing over suffering where it exists, but also not supporting those hopeless narratives. And I think of that famous image from Sudan by Kevin Carter. It was a Pulitzer winner of a small child hunched over with the vulture looming in the background. You know, did that illustrate a need for action? Did it reinforce the hopelessness? And then I also recall a newsroom conversation in 2018 about sifting images from Africa for our viewfinder feature, which is a photo showcase. And some of them were of new light rail system in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. And at the time, we talked about making sure to show a fuller picture with both images and with words. I want to excerpt Ryan again briefly on looking for the broader, more relatable human stories. Brown. International reporters and local reporters, we're really conditioned to feel like news is about important people. Important in air quotes, right? Like people in power, huge sweeping forces. And that's the level at which we want to talk about what's going on in the world, or that it makes sense to talk about what's going on in the world. So it's actually not just for local reporters, but I think for international reporters, maybe, who have come from writing from more newsy outlets, you know, where they're doing kind of breaking stories and stuff, and then come and do a story for the Monitor. It's a little bit of change of pace and a change of perspective, the kind of way that we approach the news and who we tend to focus on, and the more sort of anecdotal, the more, how has this big picture thing affected this particular small group of people, you know? This particular group of students, whatever. It's just sort of a different way of thinking about the news. Ford. Yes, we try to find stringers. Stringers are freelance correspondents. We try to find those who are already familiar with our sort of approach from work they've done elsewhere. And at the same time, we can send them examples of stories we've already published to give them a better idea of what we do and how we do it. Ryan's worked up a pretty comprehensive set of guidelines for new contributors, and she works very closely with new stringers who show promise often over quite a long period of time. That's all very well and good, but it takes a good deal of patience and dedication. But I think it's paying off because our Africa coverage is getting noticeably more diverse. It's coming more closely in line with our values, and it's generally, I think, more appealing to our readers. I mean, that reflects, among the things it reflects, is the fact that we have an Africa editor based on the continent who has her ear to the ground and a good sense of where she'll find Monitor-esque stories. I mean, Ryan has lived in Africa for a long time, and frankly, it shows. Collins, you mentioned patience and dedication as necessary virtues here. There are so many special challenges around covering so vast and varied a continent. The work is staggeringly hard, you know, logistically, emotionally, otherwise. As a foreign editor, what to you makes it worthwhile getting this kind of coverage executed and presenting these stories to readers? Ford. Well, partly just the fact that it can be so difficult, and that makes just achieving it feel worthwhile. There are letters from readers, some readers who are particularly touched by a particular story. They're always encouraging. But in the end, I think it's the way we're building a bridge between two very different worlds, between what is the predominantly American readership of the newspaper and a continent whose people are not well understood globally. It's a kind of bridge of humanity, if you like, and I find it a very fulfilling job to keep that bridge maintained. Collins. Well, thank you, Peter, for all of the remarkable bridge-building work that you and your team do, and do so routinely and so well. Ford. It's a pleasure to do it, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Clay. Collins. Thanks, Peter, and thanks to our listeners. Find links to all of the Sudan stories discussed and to previous show appearances by Peter and Ryan in our episode show notes at csmonitor.com/whywewrotethis. This episode was hosted by me, Clay Collins, and produced by Mackenzie Farkas. Jingnane Ping is also a producer on this show. Our sound engineers were Tim Malone and Morgan Anderson and Alyssa Britton, with original music by Noel Flatt, produced by the Christian Science Monitor, copyright 2024. Article number 3, Abortion on the Ballot, What's Happening in 10 Key States. This article was written by Henry Gass and Allie Martin. When the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022, eliminating the nationwide right to abortion, It handed the issue to the states and their voters. The November 5th election, more than any other moment to date, will tell us how states are responding. 10 states, accounting for one-fifth of the U.S. population, will vote on some kind of abortion amendment to their state constitution. Since the court reversed Roe and Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, the country is fractured into a patchwork of varying restrictions on access to the procedure. About half the country has measures on the books, protecting broad access to abortion, and about half the country now has strict limits or an outright ban. This election will further clarify the landscape and potentially be decisive in contests further up the ballot by driving turnout. Easier than amending the U.S. Constitution, this kind of state-by-state modulation illustrates the function that state constitutions are meant to play in American democracy, experts say. State constitutions don't have the sanctity of the federal constitution, for better or for worse, says Justin Long, an associate professor at Wayne State University Law School in Detroit. That likely means, he adds, that in coming elections, some states will see a back and forth over constitutional protections for abortion. Which states are voting, and what are they voting on? In Nebraska, voters will choose between two competing abortion amendments. One would effectively codify existing state law, which bans abortion in the second and third trimesters, with exceptions for rape, incest, and to save the life of the mother. The other proposed amendment would protect the right to abortion until viability, considered by most doctors to be around 24 weeks into a pregnancy or later to save the life of the mother. If both measures pass, Nebraska Republican Governor Jim Pillen would have to decide if they are in conflict. If he decides that they are, the amendment with the most votes would go into effect. Residents in three states with expansive abortion protections will be voting on whether to enshrine those protections in their state constitutions. In New York, where abortion has been legal up to viability since 1970, voters will consider a proposed equal rights amendment. This would expand its existing prohibition on discrimination based on race, color, and religion to include pregnancy, pregnancy outcomes, and reproductive health care and autonomy, as well as sexual orientation and gender identity. In Colorado and Maryland, two of nine states where abortion is legal at any stage in a pregnancy, proposed amendments would enshrine a right to abortion in their state constitutions. Meanwhile, Nebraska is one of five reliably red states where residents will be voting on abortion amendments. In Montana, a proposed constitutional amendment would guarantee a right to abortion before viability. After the Dobbs ruling, abortion remained legal in the state until viability, per a 1999 state Supreme Court decision. In Florida, where a recent law banned abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy, a proposed amendment would protect a right to abortion until viability. In South Dakota, where abortion has been illegal with some exceptions since 2022, residents will vote on amending the state constitution to protect a right to abortion in the first two trimesters of pregnancy. In Missouri, which also enacted a near-total ban on abortion in 2022, voters will consider a ballot measure that would establish a right to abortion until viability in the state constitution. Two purple states will also be voting on abortion amendments. In Arizona, where abortion is banned after 15 weeks of pregnancy, a proposed constitutional amendment would establish a right to abortion up to viability and later to protect the life of the mother. In Nevada, a proposed constitutional amendment would codify existing state law, which permits abortion during the first 24 weeks of pregnancy. In most of these states, passage requires simple majorities. The exceptions are Colorado and Florida, where constitutional amendments require 55% and 60% of the vote, respectively. Recent polling suggests that most of the proposed amendments are likely to pass, but Florida, with its 60% threshold, might not make it. A survey conducted last week by St. Pete Polls showed the Florida abortion amendment falling short with 54% support, while another poll by the University of North Florida showed the measure reaching the minimum 60%. In Nebraska, meanwhile, a recent poll found that a plurality of voters support both proposed amendments, but the initiative preserving the state's current 12-week ban has slightly more support. Could these votes affect other races on the ballot? Polls consistently show that supporters of the more expansive abortion rights are more likely to back Democrats than Republicans, but data also suggest that a significant proportion of conservatives would be willing to vote in favor of an amendment favoring abortion rights as well as Republican candidates. In the swing state of Arizona, for example, recent polls show a supermajority of support for the proposed abortion amendment and show Mr. Trump with a slight lead over Ms. Harris. In Montana, incumbent Democratic Senator John Tester is trailing in recent polls, but a 2023 survey found that 6 in 10 voters believe abortion should be legal in many or all circumstances. That's bolstered hope among Missouri Democrats that the ballot measure will help their party's candidates, says Stephen Rogers, an associate professor of political science at St. Louis University. But if you look at political science research, there isn't a lot of evidence that it helps, that there's reverse coattails, he says. How these amendments could make a difference is in close races, if they bring more voters to the polls. With young women in particular, who overwhelmingly support abortion rights and Ms. Harris, but are not yet considered reliable voters, an abortion amendment could attract decisive votes, experts say. If the abortion amendments have been an effective mobilization forcer, it could benefit the Democrats, says Don Levy, director of the Siena College Research Institute. What could these votes mean for abortion access? At the moment, the U.S. is split roughly in half between states where abortion is banned completely or almost completely and states where the procedure is legal in most or all circumstances. In 2022, about 21.5 million women of childbearing age lived in states that ban abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy or fewer, according to PolitiFact. If all 10 states pass their proposed abortion amendments, abortion rights will be expanded by roughly 7 million women of childbearing age. For roughly 4 million women of childbearing age, nothing will change in practice. In the abortion access states, what the amendments might do is cause legislators to enact increased protection for abortion access, such as funding or going beyond what the amendment provides, says Naomi Kahn, a professor at the University of Virginia Law School. In the abortion restrictive states, I think it's much more difficult to say what would happen. This election cycle could trigger longer-reaching changes. In some states, there are already discussions over pursuing constitutional amendments to restrict abortion again. In other states, like Arizona, residents will also be voting on ballot questions that would make it more difficult in the future to amend their state constitution. If the Missouri Amendment passes November 5th, for example, it's widely anticipated that in 2025 or 2026, we may have another amendment going the other way, says Professor Rogers. We're going to be in this abortion back and forth for a while. Our next article. John Lewis served as the conscience of the Congress. This article was written by Barbara Spindell. John Lewis's heroism is the stuff of legend. In 1965, leading 600 peaceful protesters across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, at a march for voting rights, the civil rights activist was seriously injured when state troopers attacked the procession. A photograph of him being viciously beaten by an officer shocked the United States. A week after what became known as Bloody Sunday, President Lyndon B. Johnson introduced the landmark Voting Rights Act to Congress in a televised address. David Greenberg's rich, illuminating biography, John Lewis, A Life, situates its subject's best-known act of bravery within a lifelong commitment to nonviolent protest. The author describes how Lewis, who went on to serve in Congress for more than 30 years, immersed himself in passive resistance while a student at the American Baptist Theological Seminary in Nashville, Tennessee. His path was a difficult one. Lewis was born to sharecroppers in rural Pike County, Alabama, in 1940. His father saved up to buy his own farmland when Lewis was a child. The household, which included 10 children, had no electricity or running water. But the devout young Lewis, who famously preached to the chickens on his family's land, was hungry to become educated and to involve himself in the civil rights struggle. Lewis, who also studied religion and philosophy at Fisk University, was the first person in his family to earn a college degree. In Nashville, Lewis was trained in passive resistance by the Reverend James Lawson, a significant mentor. Lewis helped organize sit-ins to desegregate the city's lunch counters in 1960. He was among the original Freedom Riders, the interracial group of activists that rode buses throughout the Jim Crow South in 1961 to challenge segregated interstate travel. Greenberg, a professor of history and journalism at Rutgers University, crafts a vivid portrayal of his subject, featuring his steely determination mixed with an unmistakable gentleness. Jesus, Gandhi, and Martin Luther King Jr. were among Lewis's influences. His profound commitment to nonviolence never wavered. "You have to love that person who's hitting you," he said. Indeed, he had been hit and kicked, cursed at, and spat upon long before Selma. During the Freedom Rides, he was badly injured by a group of young men when he walked into a whites-only waiting room in a South Carolina bus station, and he was later beaten in Montgomery by a mob. Lewis was arrested dozens of times and spent weeks in jail. He spent one birthday and one Christmas behind bars. He missed his graduation from the seminary, opting to remain jailed rather than post bail. A founding member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Lewis became the Civil Rights Organization's chair in 1963. He was one of six organizers of the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, along with King, with whom he had an affectionate relationship. Both men encountered resistance from a more militant faction of the movement, which began to question the efficacy of nonviolence. Additionally, within SNCC, Lewis was seen as too cozy with the establishment. Every time LBJ called, he'd rush his clothes to the cleaners and be on the next plane to Washington, one member griped. In 1966, Lewis was ousted as chair and replaced by the more radical Stokely Carmichael, who popularized the term Black Power. A believer in an interracial beloved community, Lewis was heartbroken when SNCC later voted to eject whites from the organization. The biography is divided into two sections. Protest is devoted to Lewis's participation in the civil rights movement, while Politics covers his more than three decades representing Georgia in the U.S. House of Representatives. It's perhaps unavoidable that the second half of the book is somewhat less gripping than the first. Greenberg's admiration for his subject runs deep, but he makes clear that Lewis was not a saint. Despite being designated one of the saints among us in a 1975 Time magazine article, his 1986 campaign for Congress pitted him against his dear friend Julian Bond, a fellow activist then serving in the Georgia State Senate. During a debate, Lewis alluded to Bond's rumored cocaine use. Lewis won the seat, but his friendship with Bond never recovered. Lewis's long congressional career was not notable for legislative achievements. Instead, his sharpest weapon, the author observes, was his moral authority. He became known as the conscience of the Congress. Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich grumbled that he needs to realize that he's now a congressman, not a protester. but Lewis relished being both. In 1988, he was arrested for demonstrating against apartheid outside the South African embassy. In 2016, he staged a sit-in on the House floor demanding action on gun control legislation. Lewis died in July 2020, not long after protests erupted across the nation in the wake of the killing of George Floyd. Weeks before his death, he addressed the demonstrators in a statement that captured his life's work. History has proven time and again that nonviolent, peaceful protest is the way to achieve the justice and equality that we all deserve. Our next article. Putin has ruled Russia for 25 years. How did he last so long? This article was written by Fred Weir. No one expected Vladimir Putin to last more than a few weeks when he was appointed prime minister a quarter century ago by then-president Boris Yeltsin. At the time, the relatively unknown, seemingly unremarkable ex-KGB agent was simply next in line after a series of failed prime ministers selected by the fading president amid spiraling crises in Russia. But last year, Mr. Putin did. An entire generation has grown up knowing no other leader. Today, having been re-elected to another six-year Kremlin term earlier this year, he has never looked so firmly in control. Still, the reasons for Mr. Putin's extraordinary ability to ride the Russian tiger so effectively for so long remain obscure. His supporters seldom mention any unusual qualities such as charisma, infallibility, or wisdom. They tend to point to the way Russia has transformed over 2.5 decades, from a dysfunctional, crime-ridden post-Soviet wreck to an orderly, relatively prosperous society where people can say they feel proud to be Russian. Most of the reforms that have remade Russia were not begun by Mr. Putin, but have reached fruition under his watch. A good example is private ownership of land, which is now a universal right. Over the past 15 years or so, the right to sell and repurpose land has produced suburban sprawl around most Russian cities that's reminiscent of North America in the 1950s, and also, along with other factors, has led to a boom in agriculture. It may not seem impressive to Westerners, but millions of contemporary homeowners are the first Russians in 1,000 years, other than a czar, who can point to a piece of land and say, "I own this," with full legal control and freedom. We don't ask why Putin is popular. It just doesn't seem like the right question, says Alexei Mukin, director of the Independent Center for Political Information in Moscow. "We concentrate on the life around us. It seems to me that when the state and society have their own separate spheres and don't interfere too much with each other, life is okay." Putin seems to have found a formula that, at least so far, works. Better than the 1990s? Mr. Putin has survived a string of harsh challenges, any of which might have wrecked the careers of many politicians. They include a tragic disaster with the sunken submarine Kursk in his first year as president, financial crisis, the seemingly irreparable rupture of relations with the West, and the most intense blizzard of sanctions ever leveled against a country. He has also faced a military mutiny that featured a march on Moscow and a costly, still ongoing war in Ukraine that he appears to have started without consulting even many of his closest advisors. Throughout all this, Mr. Putin's public approval rating has seldom dipped below 60% and is currently running around 80%. In Russian society, there is a solid base of support for the country's leader, where about 2/3 of people express loyalty regardless of the current policy, says Alexei Levinson, an expert with the Levada Center, an independent polling agency. The lowest points occurred at times of economic hardship, when the population expressed its discontent, while imperial successes, such as the 2008 war in Georgia and the 2014 annexation of Crimea, tended to boost support by up to 20%. And while political freedoms have contracted, especially since the war in Ukraine began, the private lives of the conforming majority have remained largely untouched. For Russians over 40 years old, the cataclysmic 1990s appear to be the main reference point. Perhaps Putin had a good team, but they were able to overcome the difficult crises of the 90s with all that disorder, chaos, and banditry, says Marina, a working Moscow pensioner. We've had a lot of experience with things going wrong, so obviously we cherish stability and calm. It's hard to imagine anyone but Putin at the top of this country. Putin was the one. Even Russian opposition figures, many of whom are in exile these days, don't seem to agree on the sources of Mr. Putin's political resilience. Some point to the aura of state propaganda, in which most independent and opposition voices are banished from the official airwaves. Others say deepening repressions, especially since the Ukraine war began, have created an atmosphere of fear that makes any discussion of genuine popularity impossible. Still, others stress traditional Russian political culture and say Mr. Putin has ensconced himself as a czar, who is seen by the population as above any sort of democratic accountability. Abbas Galiamov, a former Putin speechwriter turned opponent who is now living in exile, says Mr. Putin answered society's need for a strong hand following the devastating decade of the 90s, when society collapsed, the economy imploded, and all efforts to build democracy appeared to fail. Putin was the one who could satisfy this demand, he says. At first, Mr. Putin recognized the need to integrate Russia into the wider world, led by the West, he says. But since then, he's discovered that stoking nationalism and blaming the external enemy for Russia's troubles is a better formula. When the external agenda dominates, the authorities look like strong patriots, and the opposition appears to be a bunch of traitors, Mr. Galiamov says. When the focus is on internal affairs, people see the authorities as corrupt, looking out only for their own interests. The principle that Russia is surrounded by enemies has always worked well in the past. A comfortable mystery. Everyone agrees that Mr. Putin has changed over the years, reinventing his public image even as the country and its society evolved. Recently, the Menchenko Consulting Group in Moscow issued an analysis that attempts to define Mr. Putin's changing role in Russian society. Using a framing largely in line with the Russian mainstream thinking, it presents him first as a warrior who restored order to a badly fractured country, defeating Chechen separatists and exiling delinquent oligarchs in the early 2000s. Then, it says, he morphed into a caring ruler, presiding over a surge of market-driven growth and the creation of Russia's first-ever working consumer economy. In his latest incarnation, Mr. Putin is presented more as a global creator or a leader who drives the establishment of a new world order with an entirely new role for Russia. And the state-funded RT Global TV network recently released a tool that divides Mr. Putin's 25 years into three distinct periods and uses artificial intelligence to convert key speeches from each into clear spoken English. We're running out of time, so we'll wrap up the article here. Thank you for joining us for the Christian Science Monitor, read by Daniel Williams.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of AfterSight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Christian Science Monitor, please contact them directly at customerservice@csmonitor.com or call 617-450-2300 Monday through Friday.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.